This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to a Friday night edition of Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker, my usual Friday co-host, I think is in Norway speaking to civil servants. I'm not sure if it's about fully automated luxury communism. I should have asked, really. But we'll find out about that next week, I'm sure. In Aaron's place, you are in the very capable hands of David Adler of the Progressive International and good friend of the show. How are you doing, David?
It's great to be here. I had a question for you, Michael. How is the audience different on a Friday night than it is on other nights? Is it more focused, or do people usually sort of play in the background of the parties that take place kind of across the city and the country?
I don't know about people watching it. In general, the Friday shows, because it's always me and Aaron, are a little bit maybe weirder. So I suppose we maybe pick some of the sort of the more unusual topics from the week, because Aaron always has sort of these very interesting pockets of historical knowledge, which I actually think, David, you are very well placed to sort of step up to that challenge of having interesting pockets of historical knowledge that the audience might not have expected.
Very big shoes, Aaron, if you're watching, I'm going to do my best to fill them.
We will be talking tonight about the situation in Haiti, which remains tense after gangs took control of the country. The prime minister has resigned. It doesn't seem to have satisfied many people. I'm in the United States. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has called for Netanyahu to go. Are the Democrats waking up to, I suppose, the real electoral burden that their alliance with Netanyahu has caused them up until now? And on Question Time, they invite on a right-winger who denies that there is a shortage of food in Gaza. It's a pretty shocking clip from a pretty shocking guest, I have to say. Stay tuned for all of that. First, though, when the hell will Rishi Sunak call a general election? Get your answers to us. You can do so on YouTube Super Chat, or you can tweet us on the hashtag Navarra Live. And let's go straight into that first story. On May the 2nd, there will be local elections across England and Wales, but there won't be a general election. This was Rishi Sunak last night speaking to ITV West.
In several weeks' time, we've got elections for police and crime commissioners, for local councils, for mayors across the country. They're important elections.
And not a general election.
That's what I'm focused on. There won't be a general election on that day. Yeah. But when there is a general election, what matters is the choice.
The non-existence of a general election might not seem like a massive political story, but it has sent speculation into overdrive about when one might actually be. And the Independent think they've got the scoop. They say, expected general election date revealed after Rishi Sunak rules out May poll. And here's what they write. Downing Street sources told the Independent that the date has been penciled in for the second Thursday in October. It is understood that the PM is unlikely to wait until mid-November, since it would clash with the US presidential election. Number 10 dismissed the claim as speculation, but did not deny the date. A government source said the PM will announce the date. Until then, everything else is speculation. Difficult how to judge these Downing Street sources' story. I'm not sure if the Telegraph normally have sort of big scoops, but they've definitely got a lot of clicks from this particular story. On the pros and cons for waiting to call for a general election. I found this tweet this morning interesting. It's from Christian Calgi. He's a political correspondent at The Express, used to be at Guido, so presumably well-connected in the Conservative Party. He says, the positives for waiting for a general election: economy will likely improve, but he says, but by how much? Voters will feel the national insurance tax cut, will they? Inflation reaches 2%, possibly. A cut in the interest rates is possible. Farage may be too distracted by Trump election to play proper role, so that would be sort of why you might want to wait all the way until November. And possible Rwanda flights, I can't see any of those shifting it. To be fair, I'm not sure Christian Calgi can either. He's sort of clutching at straws in the same way the Conservatives are. As for the negatives, these are much more substantial. The local elections will likely be terrible. This will almost certainly spark renewed leadership questions among Tory MPs. Rwanda flights possibly tangled up in court again. Small boat crossings will resume in full flow during the summer, could even increase on last year. And then we've got even more negatives. Israel-Gaza could be resolved, lessening Labour tensions. Unknown scandals and repeat poor political management. Looks like Sunak's clinging on. So the longer you wait, the more desperate you seem. And more reform defections. So potentially more people could move to Reform UK, likely Anderson. Now, that point about Israel and Gaza might seem especially cynical. So you're looking at this really, really deadly conflict. You've got loads and loads of civilians on the brink of starvation, 30,000 people dead. And you're thinking, oh, would it be bad for our electoral chances if this were to clear up, you know, if there were to be peace? Well, apparently it's not too far-fetched that that is really going into Tory calculations. Ministers, in fact, are apparently genuinely worried that peace might break out in the Middle East.
You hear extraordinary claims from Tory MPs, including this one, Jonathan, from a minister who said to me that they are worried that there might be peace in the Middle East and that might help Labour because they're currently suffering because of what's going on in Gaza, and that's severing the relationship between their traditional Muslim vote and that party. Extraordinary comment because we're in extraordinary times.
They're worried there might be peace in the Middle East. David, I know, you know, in your home country, you don't get to have these, you know, incredibly exciting speculations about when an election will be called because it's written in your constitution. And we do get to have that here. Somewhat sociopathic, isn't it? This idea we're really worried there might be peace in the Middle East, and therefore some of Labour's problems with its voting base will be resolved. So it seems that that Tory minister, at least, was wishing that there isn't a ceasefire and that the conflict will continue, but the genocidal war continues.
Yeah, but I think this Tory minister has learned it from the Republican Party of the United States. Now, if you look at Donald Trump, really since October, this is, of course, the leading presidential candidate, the biggest mouth, perhaps, on the planet, someone who can't resist saying whatever and whenever he pleases. What's remarkable is the absence of conversation around Israel and Palestine. And what's shocking about that is, I think, two things. One is because I think that there is pretty broad consensus on his highly Islamophobic base that, you know, of course, to kind of this any strain or any visible evidence of an Islamic movement led by brown people in the Middle East would need to be squashed by American bombs and bullets. We saw in the GOP presidential debates the genocidal rhetoric that was touted by Republican candidates: kill them all, exterminate them all, smash Gaza to smithereens. But what's remarkable about Trump is how little he's spoken about Israel, how little he's mentioned Palestine and Gaza. And it's tough to tell if that's a kind of Sun Tzu type of, you know, don't move or make a move while your enemy is, you know, having trouble politically with the respective kind of cross pressure in their own party. But it certainly reflects that this cynicism, deeply cynical, you might call it genocidal cynicism, is not exclusive to the Tory Party in the United Kingdom, but rather is something that is being studied rather rigorously by their friends across the pond.
Yeah, it's interesting that Donald Trump isn't exploiting it, because I suppose in terms of UK domestic politics, I think what's going on is that the Tories want to raise the stakes when it comes to the Palestine issue, because they think that, you know, some white voters will be turned off by left-wingers going on demonstrations against a genocidal war, because they're trying to sort of say these are all actually Muslim extremists who Labour will support, and it's only the Conservatives who are going to get Muslim extremists under control. Obviously, you know, a ridiculous narrative, but you can see why they want to push that. And then Labour sort of trying to downplay the issue because they've got a really weak position on Palestine that doesn't please their base. And also, they know that sort of if you were a somewhat, you know, Islamophobic voter, then the more you were talking about Gaza protests, the more you were going to be inclined to think, oh, that Keir Starmer guy, not sure about him. So there's this real sort of, yeah, incentive on the part of the Conservatives to talk about Gaza, and incentive on the part of Labour not to talk about it. It makes me surprised somewhat, actually, that in the United States, Donald Trump isn't banging on about this. So, and it sounds like you're somewhat surprised about this as well. Do you have a sort of a go-to theory for why it might be?
Yeah, I think it has to do a lot with the idiosyncrasies of who is Donald Trump. It's not that the Republican Party is silent on this. I mentioned the GOP debates, but every day people are going out from the kind of leadership of the Republican Party to slam the radicals in the Democratic Party on its progressive fringe, people like Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar, who have stood up for ceasefire. I mean, you can see those tweets plastered across the internet. What's interesting is Donald Trump as a figure. I think that, you know, we could get into a long conversation about those political idiosyncrasies. Part of it has to do with a very ecumenical or syncretist foreign policy agenda, which is very much about deal making. I think that part of what Donald Trump sees in this conflict is protraction. And Donald Trump's whole thing is get deals done, no need for protracted conflict, precision strikes. Look what we did with Soleimani. You know, we're able to basically close these things up quickly and not drag the US into longstanding conflicts like the open-ended one we've launched, you know, without congressional approval against the Houthis in the Red Sea. So I think that there's something to do with Donald Trump's very particular foreign policy views that mark a kind of departure from where the U.S. security apparatus is, where the Republican leadership is, formal leadership, I should say, in the Congress, and where certainly the Democratic leadership is, which is, you know, a more traditional tic-tac-toe of American foreign policy. I'm sure we'll talk a bit more about this later, but I think it speaks to, you know, a certain pulse that Donald Trump really has on the country and on public opinion. And he can, you know, this is not necessarily a winning conflict. I think you can see from a mile away that, you know, when Israelis are saying, we're going to be doing this for months, if not years, that's something that I think Donald Trump wouldn't want to put his fingerprints all over.
Let's talk about the Democratic leadership, because they do finally seem to be recognizing, at least sort of in words, that their support for Benjamin Netanyahu has become a drag on Biden's re-election campaign. They, of course, haven't followed it up with actions yet. Chuck Schumer is the majority leader in the Senate.
The fourth major obstacle to peace is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has all too frequently bowed to the demands of extremists like Ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, and the settlers in the West Bank.
Joe Biden was asked about that speech today.
Senator Schumer contacted my staff, my senior staff, who's going to make that speech. And I'm not going to elaborate on the speech. He made a good speech, and I think he expressed a serious concern, shared not only by him, but by many Americans.
Joe Biden was at the end of a meeting with the Irish Taoiseach there, which is why you could see that badge with the American flag and the Irish flag, and I presume why he's wearing that green tie. David, is this significant? I feel like the language around Netanyahu is getting tougher from Democrats. I suppose two questions. Is it significant geopolitically? Will it sort of change their policy vis-a-vis the Gaza war? And then does it make sense electorally?
This is... I remember being on this show over the past few months, Michael, and making the same argument that we are so far in the United States from any serious pursuit of accountability, let alone justice, for the crimes of the Israeli governments, you know, before and after October. And so these are very calculated and very measured steps that really don't bear any consequence in terms of U.S.-American foreign policy. These are measured in kind of centimeters, not even, we don't have to pull out a kind of measuring tape to see how, you know, we've not really moved in the direction of any kind of boycott, sanction, or divestment, let alone even beyond a stern talking to. My sense is that what's happening to the leadership of the Democratic Party is that they realize that there's a problem and they're triangulating between the problem that they have, you know, and the policy position that they won't change, which is this basically blank check support for Israel. And so I think there's a high degree of coordination. I think, you know, when Joe Biden says Chuck Schumer called my office and ran that by me, I think it's a funny way of describing how decision making is happening inside the upper echelons of the DNC. This was a highly coordinated, approach to basically dropping some seeds of recognition or some little, you know, crumbs of recognition for the so-called uncommitted vote that's really disturbed inside the Democratic Party about the ongoing genocide in Gaza without making any substantive moves against the government. What's notable is that nothing Chuck Schumer said in that speech couldn't have been said a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or 20 years ago. You know, these are not novel observations about Netanyahu and his longstanding flirtation with the most extremist elements of the genocidal fringes of the Israeli far right. What's notable is their timing, and that timing is to coincide as a kind of appeasement measure with a growing discontent inside the Democratic Party. Now, we can have a longer conversation about the future of his uncommitted campaign, how it relates to AIPAC's massive package to unseat progressives in Congress and what that means for the broader looming election in November 2024. But I don't think that we should be fooled by some of the rhetoric that is coming out of the DNC leadership that seems to be, you know, tough on Netanyahu, not least because it's very clear in its own, by its own measure, that it's not coming with any stick, really. There's no actual attachment to the end of that declaration about any meaningful change in the U.S. approach to supporting Israel and fueling the genocide that's ongoing in Gaza across the occupied Palestinian territories.
In terms of those AIPAC challenges, we haven't talked about those on the show as far as I recall. So that's AIPAC is sort of the big Israel lobby in the United States, and they've been funding candidates to try and primary sort of left-wing pro-Palestine Democrats, so presumably like Rashida Tlaib. Can you talk about that a bit? Has it had any success, or has it sort of flopped, or do we just not know yet?
Oh, no, we know. This is what makes it very funny for me as a U.S.-American observer who lived in England for a long time. Because there, you know, you use the phrase Zionist lobby and you're accused of being some conspiratorial anti-Semite. Whereas in the U.S., not only do we have a Zionist lobby in the abstract, we have an organization called AIPAC that funds millions of dollars openly and proudly into the electoral system to unseat their enemies and to enthrone their friends. They've been extremely successful with this agenda. They have kind of rankings, you know, like the NRA has rankings. How good are you on Second Amendment gun rights in the United States? You know, APEC, sort of how good are you on Israel? And of course, you know, this is stunning. It's a very strange state of exception that we make. You know, people get accused of kind of dual loyalties in the United States. We take this very seriously. If you're a dual citizen, you know, Ilhan Omar, oftentimes the progressive congresswoman from Minnesota, gets accused a lot of times of dual loyalties. But meanwhile, AIPAC will support, you know, fundraisers for the IDF, a foreign army inside on U.S. soil. They'll openly be advocating for, you know, the Israeli government and its policies from inside the U.S. political system. Now, AIPAC has a problem in the U.S., and it's one that we've discussed on the show many times, which is that for a long time, they had a basic monopoly on political speech, expression, mobilization around the Israeli question. And then our generation of young Jews in the United States basically began to build a movement. I wouldn't yet call it anti-Zionist, but Zionist critical movement from the United States that was much more sympathetic to the cause of Palestinian liberation. And that made a big, big problem for AIPAC. Because all of a sudden there were people on campus and there were people marching and doing sit-ins in places like the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C., saying, you know, not in our name, we won't be part of this AIPAC. So this has split the U.S. American Jewish movement between these kind of forces aligned with AIPAC and those against. So let me just quickly run through the present conjuncture because it involves kind of a two-step move. So what's happening on the AIPAC side is that AIPAC has raised $100 million. I want to repeat this because I think to English, or I should even say British ears, it's such an astounding number amount of financing that could flow through our electoral system legally. $100 million that's exclusively dedicated to unseating some of the progressives who have been critical of Israel. And so we stand at a major risk of losing close to maybe a half of the so-called squad of the progressive kind of bench in the U.S. Congress, people like Cori Bush, people like Jamal Bowman, who are really at risk of being unseated through a very successful funding campaign because they get two bites out of the apple. One is through the primaries process, which is like the first porous level at which you can kind of unseat a candidate in your own party to take their spot in a general. And of course, you can fund a Republican or an independent to unseat that person in a general election. So AIPAC's just funneling money into this process, right? Campaign funds, TV ads, anything you want. And that's a real danger. Now, in the opposition to that, we've seen a coherence, the alignment, a new coalition of anti-AIPAC groups called Reject AIPAC. That's a lot of our friends, you know, Justice Democrats, a lot of these more kind of progressive groups that have gotten together to say, okay, we need to fight back against this. The problem is it's just extremely expensive. Where are you going to find millions and millions of dollars to fight back against AIPAC? And one of their good attack lines from the progressive left is to say that as this process of kind of Jewish-American polarization has taken place, the more reliable allies for AIPAC, as you know, the contradictions of the Zionist project become increasingly visible, increasingly violent, has been to straight up alignment with the Republican Party, right? Just absolutely getting into bed with people like Stephen Miller, with people like Jared Kushner, with people like Donald Trump. So one of the lines that's now taken root in the kind of progressive wing of the Democratic Party is these are just Republicans, you know? And how dare any sector of the Democratic Party, faced with what they consider to be an existential threat to our democracy in the form of Donald Trump, align themselves, let alone accept millions of dollars in donations from a nakedly, not transpartisan, but right-leaning Republican Party foundation that, yeah, is advocating a certain agenda, but is willing to spend millions of dollars to dethrone your party's representatives in service of an increasing majority in House and Senate, and of course, in the presidency for Republicans. So that's the fight that's kind of taking place. And so this is when, you know, people talk about, oh, is Gaza or is Israel becoming an issue across the electorate? Sure, I think public opinion is, you know, moving in ways that signify that raise the salience of Gaza, the Palestinian question, for many voters. But regardless, there is going to be over $100 million pummeled into our electoral system that is going to be decisive in many key swing races, both inside and out of the Democratic Party, that is going to be, you know, determined by the Zionist lobby, whether we like it or not, whether the preference for the genocide is salient or not, whether there are kitchen table issues or foreign policy issues that are dominant in people's minds, that money will still be hugely decisive in many of these key races.
Going on to our next story. 3 days after the resignation of Haiti's prime minister, gang violence in its capital, Port-au-Prince, shows no sign of abating. This is part of the most recent report from ABC News.
Haiti is collapsing. The country has been ravaged by 2 weeks of chaos, of bloodshed, of intense fighting and horrific human suffering, with no obvious way out. Port-au-Prince is no stranger to gang violence, but an unholy alliance has emerged between the most powerful armed groups, now unified behind this man, Jimmy Chercier, aka Barbecue. The unelected prime minister, Ariel Henry, resigned on Monday after agreeing to a transitional government. Henry now out after weeks of horrific violence led by Barbecue, Haiti's most notorious gang leader. He and his soldiers have launched massive coordinated assaults around Port-au-Prince for nearly 2 weeks. Dozens of police stations, many destroyed. Gang members even showing off stolen body armor. Constant assaults at the airport forced it to shut down too. The people he says he's trying to free, ordinary Haitians, are being decimated by the fighting. The violence has paralyzed Port-au-Prince, a hellscape now cut off from the outside world. Hospitals around the city show the human toll. In this major hospital, no doctors or nurses can even make it to work to help the patients. Gangs have barricaded off entire sections of the city to slow down police, attacking those who dare cross.
It does seem completely hellish. David, how should our audience understand what's going on in Haiti right now?
Our audience needs to understand what's going on in Haiti in a historical lens. And you can reach that history all the way back to the Haitian Revolution, which many of your viewers, listeners will remember was the first revolution led by Afro-descendant slaves against their French colonial masters to set themselves free. And the first country to legalize slavery as a result. And for that kind of courageous revolutionary act, they were never forgiven. And that, you know, reaches from the French demand for reparations for their lost colony in that century, all the way through a kind of 20th and 21st century colonial domination under the banner of the so-called Monroe Doctrine, which was the doctrine established now 200 years ago by the United States, proclaiming its sovereign right to govern the affairs of its hemisphere by the United States itself. And so I think it's critical to put this in the context of, you know, the way the U.S. has behaved towards Haiti as if it were a colonial possession. We led, for example, the ouster, the eviction, the coup, and the exile of Aristides, the popular leader of Haiti, who we forced out precisely for his sovereigntist vision, trying to free unleash the country from the colonial grips of the United States. And that mentality remains today. I mean, this is not a context that you're going to get in an ABC clip at all. But the United States continues to basically try to dictate the terms of Haitian governance. So that, you know, we saw a few years ago, U.S.-trained Colombian mercenaries that led the assassination of the previous prime minister, and then enthroned our guy, Ariel Henry, who has just now, as the clip noted, stepped down after it was made clear he would not be welcome to return to Haiti. But this is a person that oversaw the deterioration, slow, steady, violent, brutal, and bloody, of the country's social, economic, and political environment over the past years. And someone the United States basically kept in power against the wishes of the Haitian people. So Henri has now stepped down and left this giant power vacuum. But you know, it's critical to see the ways in which, you know, the Haitian people were crying out, marching in their millions for elections, for a process by which they could resolve their political crisis. And Henri kept promising and then revoking the promise, promising new elections and revoking the promise to keep himself in power with the stamp of authority of the United States. Now, what's happened now? Now we're in a completely deteriorated situation. And Haitians are fleeing the country, as that segment noted, and they're intensifying what the U.S. calls their migration crisis. It's a big problem for the United States because it's really hurting Joe Biden's reputation, which is why in previous weeks you would have seen Joe Biden try to put together one of the most draconian, atrocious border deals. A bipartisan one to try to curry favor with Republicans. This is the same party, of course, that was up in arms, crying foul, you know, crying crimes against humanity when Trump was in power, pushing similar policies around family separation, the denial of basic asylum rights. And so all of a sudden, this has become a real kind of national security question for the United States. And so what we're seeing now is the U.S. deploy a very familiar colonial playbook. If you look at what, you know, Haitians are actually asking for, they're saying, look, there's no doubt that the crisis, present crisis in all its dimensions, requires support of the international community. It's really an unbelievably dire situation in which our friends and allies there are absolutely terrified to leave their homes, to go to work. The country is, in fact, paralyzed. But the U.S., in an incredibly cynical fashion, has tried to push through what's called the MSS, which is a multinational security operation, where, of course, we don't want to send in our own troops. So what has the U.S. done to avoid sending in its own troops for a military intervention in Haiti? And we'll get later to the question of the efficacy of that idea of a military intervention and the historical context in which, when has a military intervention actually succeeded to stem a major security crisis that has deep social and economic roots? Well, we marched around Africa and looked for an African government that we could pay off to send troops on our dime to go kill and die in Haiti. Now, the first government that bid at that is our new client, our friend President Ruto of Kenya, who agreed on the basis of hundreds of millions of dollars in his back pocket to send Kenyan police forces, really violent Kenyan police forces, really well known for their systematic violations of human rights standards, to go to a country where they don't speak the language, they've never been to before, to deploy and kill the gangs and attempt to resolve this situation. Now, when the Kenyans came under fire for being obviously not even from a Francophone country, the U.S. expanded its MSS to include Benin. So if 1,000 police were supposed to come from Kenya, 2,000 would come from Benin, at least they speak French, and they would send also soldiers, police, to a country they don't know, they've never been to before. So they've designed this MSS that's deeply unpopular. For example, in the case of Kenya, the High Court came out and said, this is deeply unconstitutional. You can't just send our police forces to kill and die in a country on the other side of the planet. And the U.S. just said, we don't care, and gave Ruto the green light to basically override a high court decision to send Africans, Black Africans, to go kill and, you know, Afro-descendants living in Haiti. Now, what's happened in more recent days, as the crisis has continued to escalate, is that Henri, the outgoing prime minister, has stepped down, And there's a new process that was supposedly overseen by CARICOM, which is the Community of Caribbean Nations, to form a kind of provisional council that would then lead to elections and ultimately to a new government. But the US can't give up its own colonial playbook. And so what it told to that council, it put conditions on the formations of that council. And one of those conditions was that anyone who's on that council, one, couldn't have criminal links or be a gang member, but two, they had to support the MSS. So the condition for forming part of the new Haitian council is that you need to support this military intervention. That's our condition for being able to play a role in the political resolution of Haiti's present crisis. Now, why is this military intervention such a disastrous idea, on top of the reasons I named before about these people not knowing where they're from, not knowing where they are, not speaking the language, not understanding the social and political context? Well, Haiti just had one of these peacekeeping missions come a couple of decades ago under the auspices of the United Nations that led to systematic sexual violence and assault by UN peacekeepers and a massive deadly outbreak of cholera when those UN peacekeepers were defecating openly in Haiti's water sources that led to a horrible communicable disease crisis in Haiti. And the consequences of both of these, the sexual violence and the outbreak of cholera, continue to be felt by a very traumatized Haitian population today. And so I think that what we look at Haiti, which is a country that too few people talk about, too few people understand, too few people are willing to get familiar with the complexity of the particular process, I think it's a very telling conjuncture in which we know something must be done. But then when we look at the toolkit of what must be done, it's very telling that we reach for a military intervention. You know, we have to try, in a world that is now spiraling into these hot conflicts, whether they be in Ukraine, whether they be in Gaza, to remember that peace processes can succeed and that peace processes are not conducted through the escalation of violence, but rather through understanding their root causes. So why does a 16-year-old kid pick up a pistol when he's looking at the face of his child or his sister or his mother or his grandmother or his uncle or his aunt and seeing that they're scared and they're hungry? Well, he does it so he can protect himself, protect his family, and yes, find a way to get some food on the table. Now, you don't fight that with a gun unless you want to intensify that cycle of violence, unless you want to do, as we've seen in El Salvador, you want to pull from that Bukele playbook. Yeah, you can build those prisons and kill those people and lead to a kind of pandemic of violence that will consolidate authority and lead to a totally authoritarian situation. Or you can attempt to build a true social consensus on the basis of genuine diplomacy and conversation and deliberation. Now, it's crazy to me, it's sad to me that we live in a world in which that latter possibility seems like a pipe dream, in which people can't imagine the idea of sitting down and talking about the conditions under which people would disarm, demilitarize, in which gangs, in which a 16-year-old kid would say, of course, I don't want to wake up every morning fearing for my death and the death of my family. Of course, I want to find a way to go to school, to get a job, and all these things. But the United States systematically refuses to have a conversation about root causes. And this reflects a fundamental contradiction, a cognitive dissonant contradiction in U.S. foreign policy and the application of the so-called Monroe Doctrine. On the one hand, the U.S. hates nothing more than a migrant. We want to systematically criminalize, the pursuit of asylum in our country. That's a bipartisan agenda. We want to put, razor wire along the border. We want to invade Mexico, as many Republicans are mentioning. We're very, very intent on violating international law and deporting as many of these people as possible. That's serious. We talk about the border crisis nonstop in the United States. On the other hand, we refuse to deal with the root causes of that migrant crisis, whether that's applying sanctions in Venezuela, a blockade in Cuba, or leading a military intervention in Haiti. We refuse to address the root causes of forced migration that are driving that so-called migrant crisis. And instead, we prefer options, which is currently on the table, and I'm very confident will go forward, of opening Guantanamo Bay, a former kind of black site for the torture of the victims of the war on terror, to hold Haitian migrants that are pursuing asylum for the consequences of our own foreign policy decisions in Haiti, that we just would rather hold them in illegal detention on an illegally occupied island of Cuba at Guantanamo Bay than have a conversation about what it might take to create the social, political, and economic conditions for people to flourish, for, you know, pursue education, live a good life. That's just not a conversation that our security apparatus is willing to have, because the tool we just keep reaching for is more violence, more guns, more bullets, more bombs. And that is creating this whole ecosystem of forced displacement and dispossession, not just in Haiti, but through Central America and really across the Western Hemisphere.
So, I mean, I think everyone would probably agree that sort of the root causes of what's going on in Haiti, I suppose, however much you know about it, right? You don't need to know much to sort of see that the root causes are sort of a very weak state and poverty, and you can sort of pick your explanation for why that is. And I suppose I want to talk a bit about sort of why that might be. And I think useful context, or at least sort of provocative context, let's say, something which poses questions, is that Haiti shares an island with the Dominican Republic. So they both have the same population. So on that level, very similar, both just over 11 million people. But the two countries couldn't be more different, really, other than that. So the Haitian economy has been stagnant for decades. So in 1990, GDP per capita was just under $4,000. 3 decades later, it's lower than then. So it's now at $3,000. Meanwhile, in the Dominican Republic, so just next door, in the same time, they went from $6,000 per capita to $18,000. So, David, I 100% agree with you. You know, the root causes, I'm sure, of the violence we're seeing in Haiti is the fact that, you know, people don't have opportunities that they can go for, and so they turn to gangs, and then there isn't a strong state that can protect you, so you need to join a gang to protect yourself, et cetera, et cetera. But it's unclear to me, and I'm not an expert on this, so this is a genuine question, why Haiti has had so much more of a difficult time than the Dominican Republic sort of getting any growth. Because I suppose, you know, there is this argument that it's about the slave revolt and the successful revolution in 1804, which, yes, definitely for sort of 100 years or so, I think they were paying back debts, weren't they, until 1950. So that did incur the wrath of the world system and would have sort of hindered development. But is it still that? Is it that Dominican Republic is rich and Haiti is poor because people still won't forgive Haiti for having overthrown colonialism in 1804? Or is something else going on here?
No, there's a much more recent history of intervention that's sort of well documented in its disastrous consequences. So I mentioned, of course, the coup of Aristide, which was a really important point in the trajectory of Haitian political economy. This was a figure who did succeed to create the kind of social and political consensus that could have led to a period of stability and prosperity for the country. We weren't having that.
Why weren't the Americans having that? My question is about the why. So why were the Americans happy to see the Dominican Republic become successful, but Haiti not? As far as I understand, it wasn't that there was sort of like communist, it wasn't sort of a Cuba situation where there was this ideological threat from Haiti. Why did Haiti bear the brunt of sort of imperial aggression, whereas its neighbor didn't? That's kind of what I'm getting at. I recognize there have been these interventions. I'm trying to understand why there might have been those interventions.
Yeah, I think, you know, I would encourage your viewers to read a bit more about Aristide and who he was and what kind of ideological threat he did actually present to the United States, both domestically and in terms of his vision for the broader Caribbean. But I think it's also important to mention the context of the earthquake. And the earthquake also fundamentally altered the political economy of the country. I mean, this was what created this kind of whole aid complex. You'll remember the stories of Hillary Clinton and you know, the kind of way in which the U.S. related to the so-called recovery efforts in Haiti that were also similarly disastrous, even as pure as they may have been in their intent. This really, really disastrous earthquake, I think it was in 2008 in Port-au-Prince in the capital. And these fundamental ways in which, you know, the U.S. has been basically determined to undermine the foundations of, you know, Haitian, I wouldn't just say democracy, but it's sort of institutional stability. So these are like multiple moments where, you know, you don't have to be conspiratorial about the operations of U.S. empire. All you have to think is that the U.S. is very opportunistic about how it relates to Haiti as a country, whether that's, you know, in supporting ousters or, you know, taking advantage of, for example, the assassination of this, of Moises to see Henri's assumption of power, this unelected government. You know, these are moments, critical junctures across that line, across that, those 3 decades of the graph you showed, Michael, in which there have been opportunities to sit down and pursue a kind of process that would, again, generate the social consensus on which you build a democracy. And instead, we've tried to install puppet governments, puppet regimes, and those don't succeed to, you know, those aren't the type of institutions that are inclusive and legitimate enough to allow for that kind of growth, to allow for GDP to flourish. So I think that there are, you know, really, really critical differences. I would discourage your viewers from thinking that if you look at the DR and you look at Haiti, that there's some kind of natural experiment in thinking about, you know, what happens if capitalism, for example, is applied correctly, or the even much more racist view that many people attempt to push, that there's something racially different about the composition of the Dominican Republic and the more, you know, Afro-descendant composition of Haiti, but instead to look at a broader trajectory of institutional rupture and institutional development that has led us to the present crisis. And I think that what we're likely to see and what we're trying to avoid, if you talk to Haitians, as I have been, you know, they'll tell you, you know, we don't have a perfect solution to what needs to be done. We know, you know, public services are paralyzed, violence is spiraling, but we do know, we do have enough recent experience with a foreign occupation and a foreign intervention. And it's crazy to us that this sounds to the U.S. without advising us, without telling us anything. And one of the main complaints that that Haitians have about the U.S. supporting, endorsing, and bolstering the government Ariel Henry, the unelected government for so many years, was this guy never even talked to us. We had no idea what was going on in our country this whole time. Now, those are not the conditions in which a stable economy, in which businesses can flourish, in which there can be a kind of political economy that's functional. And so I do think that it's, you know, has to do with a colonial architecture, the way in which the United States relates to its Caribbean possessions, that I think requires a lot of nuance, but a lot of attention to those moments when things could have gone differently for Haiti, such as with the Aristide government. Things could have gone differently, and we just refused to let them go differently. And that right now is another one of those points. Things could go differently, but the U.S. is imposing the same conditions around support for this so-called MSS, this foreign occupation, that will lead to another decade, another lost decade of violence in the country. And that is the kind of premonition that I think many Haitians have. And it's a kind of warning that we're trying to put out to the international community, which, as I said before, is paying all too little attention to this crisis. And it could be all too easily swayed by saying, oh, great, well, at least we're doing something, when the something that we're doing is highly cynical and is almost guaranteed to fail. And those are the things that raise concerns, not just about human rights, but about that graph you showed, about the trajectory of political, social, and economic flourishing in a country that has suffered so much, suffered so greatly over the past half century.
Next story, we've got two more to go through. Mehdi Hassan is an exceptional interviewer, but now he's left MSNBC. He's finding himself answering questions instead of asking them. He's gone on Piers Morgan, and the most interesting exchange concerned Hamas and terrorism.
It was an act of terrorism, and Hamas are terrorists. That's your position.
I think the Hamas fighters who went into Israel and killed civilians and kidnapped babies, certainly I would call them terrorists. Right. Just as I call Israeli soldiers who kidnap children and kill children terrorists. I use the terrorist label more freely because otherwise it's just a politicized, empty phrase that we just apply to our enemies. What I would say, Piers, is that I find it a problem, and you know this, you've joked about all the memes about you, this obsession with what we call Hamas, which is a question you pose. Let's be honest, Piers, to most of your pro-Palestinian brown guests, you don't ask your Israeli or Jewish or pro-Israeli guests to condemn Israeli terrorism or Israeli war crimes at the start of an interview in the way you
do. Well, no, I've been asked directly. I've been asked directly whether I think Israel are terrorists, and I've said no.
There's an interesting answer from Piers Morgan, because he essentially says, well, the reason I ask pro-Palestinian people if Hamas are terrorists and I don't ask pro-Israeli people if Israel are terrorists is because I don't think Israel are committing terrorism. So sort of, I only dispute people when I personally disagree with them. I suppose maybe that's a reasonable way to conduct interviews. I feel like maybe he should be trying to challenge his own beliefs as well as just challenge other people's. Of course, you know, Mehdi Hassan also sort of opened up the possibilities there, because even if he doesn't think that Israel are terrorists, why doesn't he push those Israelis on war crimes? Right. If you don't want to say, do you condemn this act of terrorism? Why don't you say, do you condemn this war crime that Israel have so clearly committed? In any case, Mehdi Hassan continues on this argument very effectively. Let's go back to the clip.
I don't think they are. I think they had a right to defend themselves. The question is the scale.
That wasn't the point I made, Piers.
Let me finish my sentence. No, Mehdi, it's not your show. It's mine. I wanted to say that the whole interview, by the way. So we got that out of the way. It's a joke. I'm joking. But the point I would make is, I think that I asked all the pro-Palestinian guests who've come on that question quite quickly, because I think it reveals a state of mind. If, like you, and I'm sorry, I didn't realise you had in that first piece on MSNBC done that. So I take back the suggestion you hadn't. And I'm glad that you have called them that. I don't think you can call them anything else. So the moment you have a pro-Palestinian guest who wants to avoid calling what Hamas did an act of terrorism by terrorists, I think it's very revealing about their mindset. And I think it's the wrong mindset.
Here's my problem with that. Why is that not applied to your Israeli guests? I would be fine, Piers, if you had Palestinian guests and you begin by asking them, do you condemn Hamas war crimes? Because what Hamas did on October 7th was a war crime. But then you should start with Israeli guests and pro-Israeli guests saying, do you condemn Israeli war crimes, which have been documented by the UN, every human rights group on the planet. You don't. You had Naftali Bennett, the former Israeli prime minister, on a couple of weeks ago. I watched the interview. Your opening question was, how comfortable are you with the way Israel's prosecuting the war? Right. Bit of a softball to start with. You didn't ask him to condemn Israeli terrorism, Israeli war crimes, Israeli genocide in Gaza. So a lot of people look at that and they say, they get your intention, but it comes across as a bit of a racist double standard.
So smooth. So smooth, so in control, always very effective when you've got the receipts as well. He's looked at an interview he's done 2 weeks earlier with Naftali Bennett. Says, you asked a much more soft question than you do when you're talking to a pro-Palestinian, usually a pro-Palestinian brown guest, right? That's how you can bring in that racist double standard charge. Let's look at our final clip of that exchange. They're talking here about why Piers Morgan doesn't think Israel are terrorists.
People do ask me, do you think Israel are terrorists? And I've said, no, I don't think they are. But I have repeated...
Why?
Well, I have repeated...
Why?
Because I think they...
Out of interest, why?
Because they were responding to an act of terrorism so heinous, it demanded a massive military response. The question for me that's caused me a moral quandary is what is an acceptably proportionate level of response? And I don't know the answer. But I don't think you can call people responding to an act of terror on that scale, terrorists for responding. What you can do is hold them to account.
The problem, Piers, is if you go to Gaza, Piers, and you talk to Palestinians, they will say that Hamas were responding. If we play the who started it game, we go back many decades.
Well, when
what we
did
need
Israel,
to have is a consistent
when did Israel
moral
kill?
What we need to have is...
Well, hang on. When did Israel kill 1,200 Palestinians?
When did Israel kill hundreds of Palestinian civilians?
When did they kill 800 Palestinian civilians in one few-hour period? Right, in the way that Hamas killed those
But that's
those
not
Israelis.
The definition of terrorism, how many hours you do it in. I can mention many Israeli massacres going back to Sabra and Shatila, which they oversaw, going back to Kibia and Ariel Sharon, going back to Deir Yassin, where rape and violence happened. The point is not to compare atrocities. The point, Piers, is to have a consistent moral principle, which is to say, if you kill civilians for a political cause, you are a terrorist. On that basis, Hamas have committed acts of terror and Israel have committed acts of terror. I think that's only fair to say that.
Yeah, listen, you're perfectly entitled to say it.
That was such a cop-out. Piers Morgan like just moves on after that. You're perfectly entitled to say that. Yeah, but is he right? He's obviously right, right? You're perfectly entitled to say that. It's such a sort of way of, okay, back off, right? He was right. Is it, the idea that you can possibly say it's not terrorism if they were provoked is just the most, which is Piers Morgan's argument, right? It's the most transparently juvenile, flawed argument if you're going to try and call anyone anywhere a terrorist, right? Pretty much every act of violence is provoked to some extent, right? People don't normally just sort of commit random acts of violence for no reason whatsoever. So if you're saying a provocation means it can't be terrorism, then you definitely cannot say that October the 7th was terrorism, right? Because, you know, you can say a lot of things about October the 7th, but it didn't come in a vacuum. It came after decades of illegal occupation. So I think Mehdi Hassan very much won that.
I'm torn about Piers. I think on the one hand, it's remarkable that he's having these conversations on his show. You know, you and I spoke about this a few months ago, that the Israeli gamble of this protracted conflict was that people would stop paying attention, that it would go the way of the Ukraine war, where the public interest would fade, which would create more space for them to operate with greater impunity. And I think that there's some evidence that much of the Western media is complicit in that game of, you know, reducing the pressure, of taking the boil down, on accountability or at least visibility of Israel's assault on Gaza. And I think it's remarkable that Piers Morgan, as someone who we could have expected to basically just stop talking about the issue, is having these conversations. At the same time, that conversation, I mean, could have happened. It's like something that could have happened 5 years ago. You know, we're looking in the context of an actual genocide and an imminent invasion that has been, you know, already condemned by Israel's strongest allies, in which an international court of justice has ruled that anyone's complicity in the violation of its provisional measures, such as supplying arms for the slaughter of Palestinians, is a violation of international law. Why are we having these debates about, you know, who is and isn't a terrorist, rather than having a debate around how we can basically apply those standards, norms, and laws that supposedly unite all sides of this conflict? So I think that there's a double risk here. The first risk is the one in which the violence, horrendous violence, kind of disappears from view. The other is that we talk about the issue, but in such facile terms that don't reflect the gravity of the situation, that don't reflect the consequences of some of the more imminent actions or daily actions to cleanse, perhaps annex this territory. I think that that's a secondary risk that we need to be cautious about. But yeah, always good to see Piers get thrown in the trash can.
Let's go straight on to our final story. In a week where political debate has been dominated by the question of political extremism, BBC Question Time decided to invite Melanie Phillips on their show. Yes, that's the same Melanie Phillips who demanded that Barack Obama explain when and why he renounced Islam. Obama was never, in fact, a Muslim. It's also the Melanie Phillips who declared in the Jewish Chronicle that Islamophobia was a bogus label. And it's the Melanie Phillips who, for decades, argued that climate change was a hoax. Anyway, this is what happened on Question Time with Melanie Phillips when the topic of Gaza came up.
I live mainly in Israel. I come here a great deal. I am British. I will always be British. And it is a tragedy beyond measure that so many decent people, well-meaning people in Britain, have got this completely the wrong way around. What's happening in Gaza is indeed a tragedy. War is terrible. Civilians are killed. But what Stephen has just said is so distorted and so untrue. Let me just take you to one or two points that he has said.
That's cool.
He says that the Gazans are being denied by Israel access to food and humanitarian supplies.
Yes.
This is completely untrue. There have been hundreds and hundreds of trucks going through Gaza. There have been hundreds of trucks stopped by going through Gaza because the food is being stolen by Hamas. The Gazans themselves are saying this. You laugh because you don't know. I am telling you.
But hang on. Melanie, in fairness, the UN says that not enough trucks are being allowed in and that children are dying of starvation. You've got UNICEF saying children are dying of starvation.
The UN has had its own operatives in UNRWA, the Relief and Welfare Organization, who are members of Hamas, dozens and dozens of them. Yeah. They are entirely compromised.
Okay, so I'll let you speak, I promise. But just to be clear what you're saying, when you've got the WHO and the UN and the EU humanitarian chief saying there is famine in Gaza, you're saying that's not true.
You can go on YouTube and see pictures of the stocked food markets in Gaza. Why are you laughing? Have you seen these video pictures?
I have looked at some of them. They don't have timestamps on them. I've got to point that out. So I don't know when these pictures were taken.
Okay.
I mean, if you have proof that they were taken in the last October.
If you want to look at pictures, Melanie, I'm quite happy to send you some pictures and videos of civilians being bombed and slaughtered.
That was Melanie Phillips telling the audience to ignore the World Health Organization and to ignore the United Nations because she's seen some pictures on YouTube. The SNP's Stephen Flynn then offered to show her some other pictures, and if he ever got the chance, I'm not sure he did, he could have done well to show her these.
Tiny limbs, bones protruding. The constant sound of crying from children now facing starvation in Gaza. In this overrun hospital ward, anxious mothers watch on as doctors provide whatever care they still can. But for some, there is nothing more to be done. 3-year-old Mila, who had been suffering from acute malnutrition, now another victim of this merciless war. She was healthy. There was nothing wrong with her before, Mila's mother says. Then suddenly, everything dropped. She wasn't eating anything. We had no milk, no eggs, nothing. She used to eat eggs every day before the war, but now we have nothing. Across Gaza, too many are feeling the pain of this deepening hunger crisis. Small children, emaciated and malnourished. These were little Yazan's final moments. His tiny fingers gripped in his mother's hand. He, like Mila, would not make it. Others are still just barely holding on. But there is no telling how long they will survive. Standing beside Mila's body, Dr. Ahmed Salem says many children at this hospital are now dying due to a lack of food and oxygen supplies.
We showed you those images last week. We showed you a bit more of that CNN report. Incredibly powerful, tragic, infuriating, horrifying report, right, of kids currently starving, right? They could be living decent lives, but Israel has decided that they want to carry out a genocidal war, has stopped any food getting in. But Melanie Phillips has seen a YouTube video where there are some stocked shops. Now, these videos don't have any timestamps, as was made clear by Fiona Bruce, the host of Question Time. And also, 2 million people live in Gaza. If it does happen that there is one shop which is fully stocked, that doesn't mean that there won't be people dying of starvation, as we know there are in Gaza, right? So how you can possibly go on national television and say, you know, the way she said that, you know, you laugh because you don't know, and then her evidence countering the World Health Organization, countering the United Nations, countering horrific images like those that the whole world can see, is that she's seen a picture on YouTube. So knowingly or not, Melanie Phillips told an ill-informed lie, which, if people believe her, if they believe the lie, could cost lots of lives, right? If people believe Melanie Phillips that there isn't famine conditions in Gaza, then they are more likely to believe the Israelis, to not apply pressure on their governments to help resolve this or to stop supporting Israel to carry out this genocidal war. If they believe her, it's very possible that will, you know, directly lead to more kids dying, right? This is what misinformation can do. And it wouldn't be the first time that Melanie Phillips has told dangerous untruths from the Question Time platform. This was from an appearance in 2013.
There is no evidence for global warming. That is to say, there is no evidence. Wait, please. I know that you are an audience of open minds. You've already showed it so
this evening. Melanie, come to the point and get on with it, would you, please? Because then we can have other people involved in the discussion.
Let me tell you that the seas are not rising any more than is in any way out of the ordinary. The ice is not decreasing, it is increasing. The polar bears are increasing in number, and the temperature is going down, not up.
As late as 2022, Melanie Phillips was claiming in the Times that climate change was bogus. Now, I can't imagine there are many climate change deniers in our audience, but in case you've randomly found us, you're very welcome. Whatever your views, you're very welcome. This is my favorite chart showing the reality of the situation. It's from the University of Reading and has a bar for each year between 1850 and the present day, showing how temperatures differed in that year from the average between 1971 and the year 2000. As you can see, it's been getting consistently warmer since 1900, and temperatures have absolutely rocketed since 2000. Climate change very much exists. That was clear to everyone in 2013. It was even clearer to everyone in 2022, but Melanie Phillips doesn't seem to have much relationship to the truth, no matter how serious the issue she decides she is qualified to talk on. David, as an American, you might have until now been spared the knowledge of Melanie Phillips' existence. Do I have to apologize for introducing you to her, or were you did you have prior knowledge of this woman?
You know, Michael, my mother is a divorce lawyer. Professionally, she divorces people. What I learned from her practice, from these acrimonious divorces, is that both sides of divorce think that they're right. That no one who's leaving their partner and you know, trying to enter into that mortal battle in a divorce thinks that actually the other person was the right person and they're the bad one. And so what I learned is that everyone puts their head on the pillow at night, telling themselves some story in which they're the good ones and everyone else is the bad ones. The things that they said and did that day were justified, rationalized, if not outright righteous. The thing with Melanie Phillips, I wonder, what is the story that this person can tell themselves, looking back on these clips over so many years of public deception, in this case, of genocidal deception, that she can put her head on the pillow at night and say, I've done well today. And this is where my faith in humanity has been strained to its breaking point in the past months and weeks. The clips you played, you know, almost brought me to tears, as they always do, these starving children, and the knowledge that we sitting here in respective capitals have the power to save those children, and yet we are determined not to do so. And how these people that we call our fellow citizens can go to bed in the evenings and look at themselves in the mirror in the mornings and live with themselves, I just struggle to understand.
My apologies. When you first started talking about your mother being a divorce lawyer, I thought you were going to tell me that's how you knew who Melanie Phillips was, because she sort of employed her to divorce someone at some point. I've got no idea if Melanie Phillips is ever divorced, but your answer was in fact much more meaningful than some gossip along those lines. David, thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Always a pleasure, Michael.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Come back on Monday. Have a great weekend. You've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.